Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello there, movie truthers. It's Michael Leader here, back hosting one of these remotely recorded Truth and Movies episodes. It's been a long time, right? But we're back, and I'm thrilled to welcome back with me Adam Woodward.
Hello.
And Hannah Woodhead.
Hello.
Very quickly, guys, how are you doing? Adam, how's it been? It's been a long time.
It's been a while. I think the last time we were on together was the Movie Soundtracks podcast we did, which was way back, I think, maybe during the first lockdown, which feels, I mean, probably only a few months ago, but it feels like a lifetime. So it's a pleasure to be back podding with you today.
The pleasure's mutual. Hannah, also love to speak to you again. You're currently up north, right?
Yeah, so I have decamped from London to Sheffield because I didn't want to do another lockdown in London. So I'm living on my mum's sofa until January now, which is presenting its, you know, unique set of challenges, especially when it comes to recording a podcast. Listeners will be delighted to know that it took me a good like 50 minutes to find a microphone that would work in this house, and there is currently a man fitting new windows in our house, so if you hear any kind of drilling and banging, it's the double glazing men. So I apologize for that.
I mean, it's all part of the lockdown colour, isn't it? Also, you have cats, so that's the good part. We might hear cats on this recording.
Yeah, you may hear my cat. We do have family cats who kind of are roaming around the house, but they're not allowed in the living room, which is where I am. But my new cat, Margot, is in the living room. So if at any point I kind of exclaim loudly, it might be because we've made a great point about David Fincher, but it's probably because the cat has jumped on me. So again, yeah, apologies for all the quote unquote colour that I am bringing to this podcast.
So I must ask, is Margot named after Margot at the Wedding, Margot Tenenbaum, or Margot Dunn from Gone Girl?
You know, I got an Instagram DM asking if she was named after Margot Robbie, and it hadn't even occurred to me that there is a very famous Margot. It was actually after Margot Tenenbaum from the Royal Tenenbaums, because she's much like Margot Tenenbaum, she's a little lady who knows her own mind. So,
Well, we've literally let the cat out of the bag there in terms of today's topic. We're talking about the films of David Fincher in anticipation of his new film Mank, which is going to be on Netflix from the 4th of December. Of course, the new issue of Little White Lies is a Mank special as well. Adam, can you tell us a little bit about what's in the new issue?
I can do, yeah. We've got a pretty meaty interview with the man himself, which the other David Jenkins has done, and that's a really, really cracking read. We've also gone deep on the history of Citizen Kane, but kind of looking at the people involved in the film, which maybe didn't get the credit they would deserve, like famously Herman Mankiewicz. You know, although he won this Oscar, he's sort of relegated to the footnotes of history as far as the film is concerned. So I did a little piece excavating some of the unsung heroes of that film. And yeah, there's loads more beside. I think it's a really good issue. Really pleased with this one.
That's really exciting. Unfortunately, in England, at least, we can't go and buy the issue on store shelves. But where can we get it from? LWLies.com?
LWLies.com. And if you subscribe, obviously, that's the kind of quickest and easiest way to get the mag. I think it is actually on a few shelves somewhere, like WH Smith's seems to be open for the most part here still, having now been deemed to be an essential shop. Which is nice. And yeah, we're selling it. I think this issue, we're going to keep it on shelves for a bit longer just to give people the chance to buy it.
Lovely. We'll be talking in detail about Mank in a future episode. For this episode, we're going to look at a broader view of David Fincher. We've each brought a Fincher film to talk about in a sort of show and tell style. But before we dive in, let's have a listen to a trailer from Mank.
Mank, it's Orson Welles.
Of course it is.
I think it's time we talk.
What is it the writer says? Tell the story you know.
Hello, everyone.
Make yourself to home, Mr. Mankiewicz, or shall I call you Herman?
Please, call me Mank.
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 This is Herman Mankiewicz, but we're to call him Mank.
Mankiewicz. Herman Mankiewicz, New York playwright and drama critic.
Turned humble screenwriter, Mr. Hearst.
This is a business where the buyer gets nothing for his money but a memory. What he bought still belongs to the man who sold it. That's the real magic of the movies.
Thunder, lightning, blood, fire, religion.
Help! Someone save me!
All in one film.
That's director proof.
That's why I always want Mank around.
I hear you're hunting dangerous game.
God bless William Randolph Hearst.
Ready and willing to hunt the great white whale?
Just call me Ahab.
Do come in.
At this rate, you will never finish.
You said 90 days. Well, said 60. I'm doing the best I can.
I've put up with your suicidal drinking, your compulsive gambling, your silly platonic affairs. You owe me, Herman.
Who do you think you are?
You're nothing but a court jester.
What I want to know is what you think of it.
It's a bit of a jumble, a collection of fragments that leap around in time like Mexican jumping beans.
Welcome to my mind, old sock.
Him, I get. But what did Marion ever do to deserve
it's this? It's not her. Not all characters are headliners. Some are secondary.
You pick a fight with Willie, you are finished. Mayor can't save you. Nobody can, especially the boy genius from New York.
I removed any distraction, eliminated every excuse. Your family, your cronies, liquor. I gave you a second chance.
You cannot capture a man's entire life in 2 hours. All you can hope is to leave the impression of one.
Why Hearst? Outside his own blonde Betty Boop, you're always his favorite dinner partner.
Are you familiar with the parable of the organ grinder's monkey?
That was the trailer for Mank, going up on Netflix on the 4th of December. And I think in some cinemas, if you're outside of England, where cinemas may still be open.
And some cinemas are going to show it when they reopen. I know the Prince Charles has announced they will be showing it. So just a little shout out, check your indie cinemas, ask them if they're going to play it. Give them all the support you can.
I agree. Good point, Hannah. Yeah, check your local listings. So David Fincher, a big filmmaker, not a very big filmography, only 11 films. I suppose before we dive into our specific picks, I'd like to know what your history with Fincher is. So, Adam, I'll come to you first. What was your first Fincher? Do you like him as a filmmaker?
Oh yeah, I mean he's one of my boys for sure. I'm struggling to think the first film of his I watched. I think I've got a feeling it was probably something like Fight Club. I have a vague memory of staying up late at night with a friend watching it on like a repeat on Channel 4 or something, and not really kind of getting it. And I suspect it was one I revisited on a film studies course at some point. So I think that would have been, I suspect like most people, that entry point was one of probably two or three films around that time. So either Seven, Fight Club. Certainly wasn't until much later that I got into, I guess, the earlier stuff and watched like Alien 3. And yeah, and I mean, since then, I've really kind of, you know, he's been pretty consistently one of my favourite filmmakers. I think the first film I properly went to see of his in the cinema would have been Zodiac. Obviously, there's quite a big gap between Panic Room and Zodiac. So I think Zodiac, I actually went along on my own and saw it at the Harbour Lights, which is now Picture House down in Southampton. And went to a late night screening of that and actually went back two more times that week to see it again because was just kind of so captivated and engrossed by it. And so, yeah, I think my love affair, although we'll find out soon enough that my pick was not Zodiac. I think just for the sake of, brevity for this podcast, I could talk until the cows come home about that film. So I wanted to sort of switch gears a bit. But yeah, Zodiac's the one I seem to always go back to. And that's really the great love of mine as far as Fincher is concerned.
He's a unique filmmaker in a way that two of his films out of his first decade as a feature filmmaker became like rite of passage movies for teenagers. And I sort of grew up in the 90s almost along with those films. Seven was a film that I definitely was too young to see on telly when my dad would have been watching it on Sky Movies growing up. And then when you're a super serious, damn the man kind of teenager, Fight Club comes along at almost the perfect point, right? In 2000. But my first Fincher probably was Alien 3. I distinctly remember that film coming out. I remember the video game and I remember the controversy around it, the divided opinion on it, and then the fact that the Alien quadrilogy, as it's called, has been released and re-released on all formats multiple times has given me many times to go back and rewatch it. And of course, we're not going to get into whether the assembly cut of Alien 3 is better than the theatrical, because it is, but also we don't want to litigate over something that could be talked about at length on Twitter. But I think actually the first Fincher I saw at the cinema was probably The Social Network, just because of the timing of it all. He was a VHS DVD filmmaker. Seven and Fight Club were in constant rotation. It's only been in the post-Social Network era of his career that I've seen him on the big screen. So it's an interesting filmmaker, actually. Hannah, not to point to you as the example of youth on our podcast, but did you come to, you naturally came to him a bit later. What was your first Fincher?
Yeah, well, I guess like I kind of was exposed to him before I really knew who he was, because I watched a lot of I don't know if they really exist anymore, but the TV channels that just show music videos, and I kind of like, I would watch those kind of constantly, especially at sleepovers. And he directed a lot of music videos for Madonna. So I kind of had seen, the videos for Vogue and things and been like, wow, these are really cool videos, and not realised that it was him behind them. And I think also as well, like Panic Room and Seven were kind of on TV a lot in the sort of mid-noughties when I was going into my teens. And I think they were kind of like, they were definitely ones that my mum was like, no, you're not watching that. It's too kind of adult for you. So I think I was kind of like subconsciously aware, but obviously the puzzle pieces didn't fall into place until much later. So I think like technically the first one that I really like sat down and watched was probably Fight Club. I remember doing an essay on it for my year 9 RE class on, we were doing about free will, and I wrote about Fight Club. My teacher must have just hated me. I guess from then on it was kind of that was it. I was absolutely hooked, and I was still even when Zodiac came out, I was definitely too young to see Zodiac when it came out, but I do remember going to see The Social Network with my friends, and obviously like, you know, they had no idea who David Fincher was. I only knew because I'd seen Fight Club and Seven by that point. And I remember the scene where the Winklevi twins are rowing the Cambridge Regatta, and in the Hall of the Mountain King is playing. I remember having this like kind of transcendental like come to Jesus moment where I was just like, this is cinema, this is what it's all about. And I really truly credit him with being like, along with the classic bro canon of Martin Scorsese and Quentin Tarantino, of being like, you know, the people who kind of got me into film and made me realize that this was something that I wanted to kind of make a career out of. So he's definitely one of my boys, as Adam said. I'm always excited for whatever he's doing. I've been kind of waiting and waiting for a new film since Gone Girl came out. So I'm thrilled that he's back in action.
Yeah. So with that in mind, I think it will be quite fascinating. We've picked three films from his career here. to go in reverse chronological order, because he has now got this reputation where whatever he's going to do next is going to be scrutinized, it's going to be hyped, it's going to be rewatched and rewatched many times. But let's go backwards. So the first pick, Hannah, is yours. Could you please introduce us to your pick?
So I have chosen Gone Girl, which obviously was his most recent film, or last film before Mank. I don't really know how to word it. And it was a film that came out when I was working in a cinema. So it kind of intrinsically felt like, you know, special to me because I was there and, like, you know, watching people come and see it and watching how horrified they were in a lot of cases. And it means enough to me that I got a tattoo from the film on my body. So I feel like that's like a, you know, that's all I can say, really. I mean, it's, you know, when it gets to that stage, it's clear that a film has a very special place in your heart. And although I love, like, I'm sure we'll talk about his other films that we haven't picked, but this for me was the one I wanted to rep for when we were deciding. And I think it's probably for me the one I don't necessarily maybe think it's his best from a technical point of view, but like from a all in, I've bought it a wholesale point of view. It's absolutely my favourite of his films.
So it was quite divisive with audiences when it was released. So you said that you could get the temperature of how it was going down when you were working in the cinema. Were you getting complaints or what?
No, I have a feeling it came out around Valentine's Day. And I seem to recall there were a lot of people who went to see it maybe not realising what they were seeing. And thinking it was going to be a kind of like, I know this came out after Gone Girl, but it was going to be a kind of like Girl on the Train type film, where it all kind of is like tied up in a neat little bow, which obviously is not, that's not never been Fincher's modus operandi. So there were a lot of people who I think were just kind of very wrong footed by it. There were others who absolutely loved it, but it was kind of like highly amusing to me as like a, you know, jaded 21-year-old to be like watching all these people come out of the cinema like furious that they'd invested all this time into this film. That it's quite a long film as well by blockbuster standards, which is definitely kind of what it was marketed as. I think they were just a bit surprised at how it all goes down in that film.
Adam, so this would have been during your tenure working with Little White Lies. Do you remember how it went down with the critics?
Oh, very much so, yeah. Well, I think, first of all, it was one of those, before it was a film, it was one of those books which everyone seemed to be talking about. And similar, I think, to something like We Need to Talk About Kevin, it seemed every time you got on a tube or a bus or, you know, everyone was reading it. And so it became this very hyped book, this hyped novel. I seem to remember a lot of the talk around the time. I mean, among critics, I think it was generally well-liked. And, you know, as Hannah said, there's so much impressive craft on display, as you kind of tend to get with Fincher. I remember there was a lot of talk around, I guess, the themes of the film and this perceived misogynistic streak within it. It's an interesting one to unpick. I think Gillian Flynn, who wrote the novel and the screenplay, I think so much of the, you know, so many of the interesting facets of the film come down to her screenplay and actually what she leaves out from her own novel and what she kind of tweaks slightly. I think, you know, very much at Fincher's request, makes it a more interesting film. And actually, I think makes it a more interesting work all round than the novel, which I think has, you know, has kind of more obvious flaws in the film. It is one of those where he hadn't made a film for a few years. You know, he'd gone on this incredible run of making almost a film a year around the kind of mid-noughties leading up to Social Network and Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. And then there's a few years off and came back with this. And I think as Hannah says, it wrong-footed a lot of people, caught a few people by surprise. You know, Ben Affleck, I don't think his stock was particularly high at the time. You know, this is kind of his pre, like, Zack Snyder, Justice League comeback. He was maybe seen as a bit of a gamble as well. Mm-hmm. I think it was maybe one of those films where people's expectations didn't quite align with the end product. But it's certainly one which I think has grown with each year and each kind of subsequent viewing. Mm-hmm. I think it's become a lot more you know, yeah, it's a lot more rich as a film.
Yeah, I went back and looked, as I often do when I rewatch films that were quite cause célèbres at the time, I looked at the Letterboxd rankings. And of course, so many mutual friends and colleagues had rated it, and it really goes from the 1 stars to the 5 stars. I must say, I loved this film. This is, having watched maybe 6 or 7 Fincher films in the last week, in anticipation of Mank, this is in the top half, maybe the top 4 or 5 for me. It's so slippery. It's so it wrong-foots you multiple times, and it ends on such a darkly comic tone. It manages to land this final half hour, which is so unexpected and bananas. But as you say, Adam, it's and Hannah, you both mentioned this, where you go into a film like Gone Girl thinking it's just the story of a crime case, a crime procedural, maybe something like a Zodiac, where it's about this missing girl. But also, in a similar way to Zodiac, it becomes about the culture around the case as much as the case itself. And in this case, it's Ben Affleck's character and his relationship with the media and the press and their response to him. And then it starts to curdle and change and warp and into something else, mutate into something else as it goes. I'm interested, you know, in one of his big interviews in the last week or two, Fincher talks about how he's interested in making a work that looks at cancel culture. There's roots of something like that in here about apologies and the public, you know, the court of opinion. It's a really fascinating film. Hannah, what is interesting, looking back at it now, there was a lot of debate at the time about whether it was a misogynistic film, right? And I'd forgotten about that completely.
Yeah, it's interesting because I guess, like, when it came out, I remember I was in my final year of university, and I remember writing about this for the student paper and being kind of, like, baffled by all the kind of claims about misogyny, because I mean I wasn't a film studies undergraduate. I was doing English and history, so I guess I didn't really have a lot of conversations about films with people, and I just didn't really understand kind of where it was coming from, because for me it sounds terrible to say it, but I thought it was quite an empowering film for women, but to be perfectly honest, I think that Amy Dunn is an icon of popular culture. I think that she is a legend, and I love her, but I can understand where that kind of view came from, and I think it is something that's actually dogged Fincher throughout his career, is this idea that he either doesn't care about female characters or doesn't really understand how to use them. I mean, he doesn't write his own scripts, so, you know, it's not that he is writing bad characters, it's just, I think, that they're often kind of misunderstood. And I think certainly in Fight Club, there were a lot of claims about Marla Singer being this kind of... I don't really know how to word it. I guess... like a kind of manic pixie dream girl, but like the goth version of that. And then in The Social Network, obviously Rooney Mara's character is presented as this, like, you know, she dumps Mark Zuckerberg and that's the whole reason we get Facebook, which is a very, like, kind of simplistic version of events. And also, like, she's a lot of people at the time were saying, like, she's the best thing in the film, she's only in it for two minutes, which is, you know, I think it's easy now to look back at Rooney Mara and say, like, oh my god, she should have had loads more screen time in A Social Network. But obviously it was 2011. I guess no one really knew or cared who she was. Whereas now it's very easy to say that. But anyway, back to Gone Girl. You know, it is basically, at a very simple level, it's a story about a woman getting revenge on her cheating husband. And you can understand why some people would see that as problematic, and I think some men would kind of see it as a, like, oh my god, women are all crazy bitches story. But for me, I never really viewed it that way, because everyone in this film is terrible. Like, every single character is just horrific. You don't sympathize with any of them, really. You kind of all think they deserve each other, from Nick and Amy Dunn, to the police, to the mistress, to Nick's sister, Margot. They're all just, like, horrible people. And while reading the novel, it's kind of, you're investing a lot more time in it, and that's why it could kind of, like, feel heavy, because you're just with these terrible people for, like, I don't know, however long it takes you to read a book. 2.5 hours is the perfect amount of time to spend with these awful people. You kind of, you go in, you watch them all like fuck each other over, and then you think, wow, I'm really glad that isn't my life. So yeah, that would be my riposte against those claims. I think it is just a story about terrible people doing terrible things to each other.
And to think about it in the its position within the Fincher filmography is, I think, quite delicious in retrospect, because after, well, we might come to this later, after a run of films where he was a bit of a provocateur and he liked going up to the edge of something very problematic and sometimes putting a toe over it, in Fight Club, in Seven, he then almost went through a little bit of a phase where it was more serious, a bit more prestige-y Oscar contention films. Of course, the peak of that being Social Network, but Zodiac and Benjamin Button certainly feed into that. And Gone Girl was really him messing with us as a filmmaker over and over again, and really not giving us a nice wrapped-up theme or a nice wrapped-up character arc that we could all get behind and finish our popcorn and go home. So I think that he as a filmmaker is so fascinating. We'll talk on another episode about Mank, but it's just fascinating to see where that fits into this arc. Before we finish on Gone Girl, though, I'd like to talk about Ben Affleck.
Yes.
Not just because, Hannah, I went back and found your tweet where you quoted from the director's commentary, which is all Fincher talking about Ben Affleck. Is he good in this?
Okay, there's a lot of debate about Ben Affleck in this film, whether Ben Affleck is good or whether Ben Affleck is Ben Affleck in Gone Girl. I am a Ben Affleck apologist in that I actually think he's quite a good actor who makes terrible decisions. But I think Gone Girl is like his masterpiece. It's his, his Citizen Kane. I think it really is, like, it plays to his strengths. I think the quotes from the commentary that you're talking about was Fincher kind of talking about why he cast Ben Affleck and why Ben Affleck was so good in the role. And it's all the kind of those four screenshots that I tweeted about. It's all like highlighting how duplicitous and sneaky Ben Affleck is as a human being. And, you know, I think the character that he was cast as is this golden boy turned kind of like downtrodden, focused on his glory days, alpha male type character. And I think it very much plays into the kind of persona of Ben Affleck that had developed throughout the kind of National Enquirer gossip rags and whatnot. But his strengths as well. I mean, Ben Affleck is kind of at his best when he is playing that all-American guy who is just trying to, like, get his life on track. And this film is, like, it takes that, but, like you're saying, it really, like, it messes with us. It messes with our expectations. It messes with the kind of these tropes of the good all-American Missouri boy. And I really think, like, it's a performance that I couldn't see anyone else doing. I find it very hard to imagine anyone else in this role than Ben Affleck. I think he was so brilliantly cast, and it really is, I imagine, like a sign of kind of good directing and kind of good casting director. I don't know if he was always like the first choice for this role. I actually should probably read up on that, because he'd never worked with Fincher before, and Fincher does kind of like to have his favourites, and I could see someone like Brad Pitt in this, but I think if it was someone that we liked a bit more within Hollywood, then, you know, the kind of the character dynamics wouldn't work. I think it kind of had to be someone that people were already like a little bit ready to hate for, in order to balance out Amy Dunn, who, you know, is the ultimate kind of like horrible female character, you know. We talk about Ben Affleck, but also like Rosamund Pike gives this like outstanding performance. And to have gone from, like, I think before this she was really only kind of known, she'd been in a Bond film, but it was really like UK audiences who knew who she was, and this was like her big kind of Hollywood moment, and she got paid absolutely nothing for it by the Academy. I really think she was robbed of an Oscar. Not that Academy Awards mean anything. But yeah, I think it is like I wish Ben Affleck got more roles like this. I think it was an incredible act of self-deprecation on his part to take this role, because it's not a flattering role. I don't think he comes off particularly well. I remember a tweet going around at the time, or like just after, saying like, oh, Ben Affleck doesn't understand Gone Girl. He doesn't know like why he was cast in Gone Girl. He just kind of turned up on set. And I'm like, no. I think Ben Affleck knows exactly why he was cast in Gone Girl. I think this was him kind of, again, like messing with us as an audience. It's a bit of a knowing wink on his part as well as Fincher's.
There's one quote in the director's commentary, I believe, or maybe it's in another profile I read with Fincher, where he says that because they put into the script that Ben Affleck's character has a villainous chin, or an untrustworthy chin, he then went straight to his agents and said, please cast me in a role with a heroic chin. And that causes the Zack Snyder Batman universe.
I think the bit which really sells it for me, and it sort of speaks to what Hannah was just saying, is the scene or the moment where he gives the first press conference and he has to sort of give this convincing, kind of sympathetic smile to the television cameras, and Ben Affleck gives this amazing, perfect, like shit-eating grin. And for someone who's like so media trained and is you know, so used to having his picture taken, I just think it's astonishing that he manages to give that, you know, that grin so convincingly, because it's obviously not his like natural smile. It's something he's worked on for this character. But it is just so perfect. And I think you're dead right, Hannah, in terms of him being someone who's, you know, he is likable and charming in his way, but he is inherently like untrustworthy as well. Whereas someone like Brad Pitt, you're like always instantly on his side. And I think Fincher and Affleck as well must have known the baggage that he carries, and that people, you know, have this preconception of him. And yeah, he works perfectly.
And it feeds into that final act quite well, whether he would actually be abhorred by the Amy Dunn's big plan, or whether he would also be a little bit respectful of it and tempted to the flame. And you need that ambiguity in this role. If you had somebody, and I wonder if Ben Affleck would have, I do wonder if Brad Pitt would have done as good a job.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This would be a good point, actually, to move on to your pick, Adam, which is Brad Pitt and then some, right?
Indeed, yeah. So I've gone for a film. I would not say, by the way, this is anywhere near being my favourite Fincher film. I think it's probably kind of middle of the pack for me, which I suppose fittingly, it's almost midway through his filmography as well. But yeah, so I've got a sort of interesting story with this one. I saw it when I was on a trip in America, and I was up in this little mountain town and went to the local cinema like the week it opened. I think this was like back when films used to come out in America still a few months before they did in the UK. And yeah, went to see it, and there was probably only half a dozen people in the screening. It's quite a late night showing, and I was the only one left there at the end. Everyone else had left. I think probably due to the runtime. It was well past midnight by the time it wrapped up. And of course, it was Benjamin Button, and it was a weird one because it was a film which I quite liked at the time, and I felt that lukewarm reception of the people in that screening with me was very much the way that generally audiences felt towards the film, even though it seemed to get quite good, critical reception. It was a film made on quite a hefty budget, actually, for Fincher's standards at that time. And it had come off the back of a period in his career where I don't think he quite had the prestige attached to his name. You know, it was a few, it was quite a while, really, after Fight Club, after Seven, all these films. So his previous film, Zodiac, which, I mean, comparatively, is a much more low-key affair and much smaller film. And I think it made a bit of money at the box office, but again, nowhere near what Benjamin Button did. So it's an interesting one to look back on because I remember really liking it. I hadn't revisited it until this week when I decided to kind of pick it for that reason for the podcast, just to sort of, you know, with Zodiac and Gone Girl and some of the other more recent films, as well as things like Seven and Fight Club, I've seen them all so many times. I know them kind of inside out. And with Benjamin Button, there were kind of scenes and images and moments which I'd kind of remembered and couldn't quite put them together in kind of one single image in my head and in terms of where they fit into the film. And I think it is very much a film of moments. I think it shows, in a way, it shows kind of the best and the worst of Fincher. You know, for anyone who's unfamiliar with the story, it's very, very loosely based on this F. Scott Fitzgerald story. But it was a script or a screenplay which was knocking around, and actually not dissimilar to Mank. It was kind of knocking around Hollywood for quite a long time. Various people were attached to it. I think initially Steven Spielberg was going to do it, and then he went off and made something called Jurassic Park, which I don't know if you've heard of. And so that worked out quite well for him. But, you know, loads of different people were attached to this. I think Charlie Kaufman had a go at writing the screenplay at one point. Ron Howard was attached to it as well, which, you know, I think we've all been saved from that one. But, you know, Fincher, I think he is a surprising choice, really, for this one. And if you look at his whole filmography now, you've got these slightly newer batch of films. I don't know whether you'd group Zodiac and Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, but certainly we've talked about Gone Girl and Zodiac and this idea of the relationship between the media and celebrity and criminals. And you've got the kind of earlier stage of his career. And I think this is a weird anomaly almost. And it's this big sweeping American classic epic. And you've got this almost like Forrest Gumpian figure in the centre of it, played brilliantly by Brad Pitt. And it's a film even now. I think Kate Blanchett says something at the time, which is quite interesting, about her being attracted and wanting to play the role and being interested by the film, in that it was a very sentimental story from one of the most cynical kind of directors that she knows that's out there. And I think that kind of nails it. You know, it's this really quite kind of maudlin story in places. And Fincher comes at it from that point of view, I think. You know, he actually does park his cynicism quite a lot, and he delivers these very beautiful moments. I think sometimes it kind of tips over into being a little bit too sentimental, but it is a film of some really poignant and beautiful images. Certainly some of the most absorbing and arresting images, I think, in his entire filmography. I mean, there's a couple which stand out, and actually a few which I'd kind of forgotten, more like little glimpses and flashes of things that you see, like at the end where there's a kind of wide shot of Cate Blanchett holding this small boy's hand. Just stuff like that. I mean, even now talking about it, I get a bit of a chill, and it's a really, you know, affecting image and story, but certainly one which I think hasn't maybe held up as well as some of his others.
Yeah, I will say the final sequence of the film, of course, Benjamin Button is aging in reverse. So there's a point where Brad Pitt's character, Benjamin Button, and Cate Blanchett's character are essentially the same age. They meet in their 40s, you know, their ages meet in their 40s. And after that, where it's this slow slip into youth and then dementia and everything else, is very effective, and it really nails this theme, this visual theme that it's been coming to for the entire film, that you can slip in and out of rhythm with other people in your life, and also that old age is like a reversion back into childhood in many ways, and it's very beautiful and affecting. My problem is that it takes 2 hours to get there.
I think that's the problem most people have with it. And actually, it's a film which I didn't appreciate for those reasons you've just given, maybe at the time. And now, as I get a bit older, and you know, I've actually experienced a relative, you know, being diagnosed with dementia and seeing that. And I think it is a film which will kind of gain potency and poignancy the older I get, and the kind of more times I revisit it. And you know, ultimately, it is a film about time and the passing of time, and it's bookended quite neatly by this story about this kind of French architect making this clock in a train station, and the clock runs backwards, and quite a kind of fitting metaphor at the end by the fact that it's replaced by a digital clock which runs forward. And that's kind of a nice kind of signal, I think, from Fincher about his own feelings towards kind of filmmaking as a craft. And you know, he's always someone who's kind of embraced digital technology, but there's something about like the mode of storytelling, which I think he kind of returns to a little bit with Mank, and you know, how films like this are being kind of usurped by, you know, much more kind of slicker effects driven machines. You don't really get medium sized movies like this anymore. I know it's made on a plus $100 million budget, and a lot of that is down to the special effects work. But it is kind of, it feels like a bit of a throwback, even though it's only just over 10 years old. It feels like it was made a lot longer now, a lot more further back. And yeah, it really feels like a film which you don't really get many films made like this anymore. And
you talk about films of this sort of great epic sweep where you almost forget whole chunks of it and focus in on these moments. When I rewatched it last week, I'd forgotten that there's a good 45 minutes of Jared Harris topless singing in Irish, in an Irish accent. If that could be lopped out and it's just focusing on Cate Blanchett and Brad Pitt, I think I'd love this film a bit more. Hannah, what's your take on Benjamin Button?
So I remember watching it a very long time ago and being kind of meh about it. And then I watched it again last night and I was similarly meh about it. To touch on something that Adam kind of mentioned, my hot take is that Benjamin Button is just Forrest Gump for people who think that they're too good for Forrest Gump. So it's, you know, I'm not a fan of this film. I think a lot of that is to do with reasons we've already touched on. I think if we could chop out all the stuff about World War II and U-boats and submarines and sailing, then I'd probably have a lot more time for it. I think if it stopped pretending it was anything other than a love story, it would be a much better film. You know, it's nearly 3 hours, and that's like a considerable investment of time for me, particularly when for most of it, kind of nothing is happening. I wouldn't have any problem with it being 3 hours if it wasn't also kind of this sort of very sentimental, like gauzy pace and like overwrought score, which is like nails on a chalkboard to me. It feels like a parody of a Terrence Malick film at times. Like it's, you know, just a lot of like people looking off into the middle distance. I sound like I'm being like horrible about this film. It's a very competent piece of filmmaking. But one thing as well, like I noticed watching it, was that the special effects on this film have not aged well. And I think that's part of the reason it feels like it was made a long time ago, because, you know, special effects have come on so much since this film was made. It just looks like quite bad. And, you know, all the scenes at the beginning where Brad Pitt is interacting with young Elle Fanning, is it, that plays a little Cate Blanchett, just felt like very, very strange and kind of like uncanny valley to me. It was even more unnerving than the idea that, like, this 70-year-old man is actually a 7-year-old boy who's like got a crush on this 7-year-old girl. I don't know, just for me it's, I would love to kind of know what it was about that story, that F. Scott Fitzgerald story, that kind of made him want to do this as a project, because it feels like a real outlier in terms of his themes as well. You know, up until this point he'd really been kind of owning the thriller corner of Hollywood, and then he just comes out with, yeah, here's my sweeping fantasy romance about a guy who ages backwards. It felt like a real like what? What a moment. And I think I definitely like one of those audience members who would have walked out of that little mountaintop cinema. I think I would have not had a lot of time for this.
Apparently, he never read the F. Scott really? Fitzgerald story. He just read the Eric Roth screenplay.
That makes it even worse.
So I think it was
like if he got some like deep-seated connection to the source material, maybe I could understand it a bit more. But no, he just loved the script. Wow, good for him, I guess.
I think that's all fair. I mean, I can't really dispute any of that. I think it's a tricky one in that. I think if you were to cut anything out, and there is a lot that you could, you know, put forward to be trimmed, I don't think the film would really work at all. It kind of hinges on this idea of like time passing and the fact that, you know, their lives intersect in this quite protracted way. And, you know, it's almost like you kind of have to go through those scenes for the scenes where him and Cate Blanchett are together. And actually, there's a really nice parallel earlier with him and Tilda Swinton as well. And that's very much about how, you know, fleeting human relationships can be and how you just happen to be passing by with someone else at a certain time and they can impact your life in so many ways. And I think, yeah, those moments are all the more sweet for the fact you've had to go through like a sweary Irish Jared Harris just kind of drunk out of his mind on rum and all of those scenes. Like, you do. It is a bit of a slog at times, but it does pay off, I think.
Yeah, I suppose it has to be this epic cradle-to-cradle narrative. It does fall into that... Hannah, you hit on something there where the sort of rules of the world are a little bit ill-defined. And rewatching it recently with my partner, we were pausing it every half an hour saying, right, okay, wait a second. Is he actually a 70-year-old man in a 7-year-old body? No, his brain is like a 7-year-old, so it's not a strange relationship. It's just the fact that he looks really old. And then likewise later, it's like, how old is he now in the 60s when they're like dancing around in their pad dressed like, you know, like their French New Wave characters, listening to the Beatles on Ed Sullivan? It's like, they're meant to be in their 30s, 40s, 19. They said 1920s here. Yeah, anyway, it's one of those where you can't help but pause it and try and really figure it out. And once you do that, it does start to fail as a pure emotional experience, maybe.
I love the fact that it's not, you know, they don't really explain his condition. At no point, there's no sort of scene with a kind of doctor or like a room full of medical experts who are trying to ascertain what his condition is and how they may be able to treat him. It's all very just taken at face value. And actually, I think one of the best relationships in the film is that with his mother, played by Taraji P. Henson. And she's really, really, I think, underrated in this film. I think she was Oscar nominated at the time, but I think people tend to focus much more on obviously like Cate Blanchett and Tilda Swinton. And I think his relationship with his mother is really, really fascinating here. Obviously, you never really see apart from the kind of very quick moment where she dies in childbirth, you don't really see his real mother at all in this film. So, you know, a lot of the film does come down to that relationship and maybe it's a bit of the kind of nature versus nurture argument, but how those very earliest like formative relationships kind of set you on a certain course in your life.
We've inadvertently picked, you know, quite left field choices, perhaps. But it is interesting, Adam, that you and I have chosen transitional films in a way. As you said, Adam, like this feels like an odd fish in the Fincher filmography because then he then goes and finds a whole new track afterwards with The Social Network. He starts working with Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. That firms up a certain tone and vibe for all his films subsequently. I've picked Panic Room from 2002, which is another transitional film. This is coming off his first handful of films. Well, let's ignore Alien 3 for this analogy, but when he makes Seven, The Game and Fight Club, he sets himself up as this sort of bad boy filmmaker, thrill in the thriller vein, as you said, Hannah, almost a modern day Hitchcock in the way that he has these big high concept themes where it's all about the one line aspect of the story, but then so many great sequences. Panic Room is the ultimate version of that, where it's high concept in the purest sense because it's all, the majority of it is about a panic room in a house. But it's transitional in the sense that it's of the era where you could raise this mid-high budget to make an enclosed thriller where the majority of that budget would go towards actual physical practical effects, where they actually build an entire set that is the size of this very nice New York apartment so he can then play with his camera within it. Transitional 2, because it's the first time that he fully moves into a digital space. You know, of course, Fight Club has all sorts of digital trickery in it, but this is one where he'd done, I think it was like 2/3 of the film, he'd done previs on beforehand. So really, we've not really touched on the fact that David Fincher has this reputation as a person who does 200 takes just to get a car pulling into a driveway. But this is the film where he develops that reputation, where he'd pre-visualised 2/3 of the film, and then really the job on set was just to light things correctly and have the camera just enact what he had in his head. So you have crazy things like an amazing long take at the beginning of the film where the camera just swoops around this building doing these impossible digital moves. Another one where the camera goes along a kitchen counter, like through the curve of a tap. Insane visual flourishes. But at the heart of it, it is this enclosed, old-fashioned thriller of Jodie Foster and Kristen Stewart as a kid, you know, with a home invasion, with these thieves coming in to try and get money that's in the panic room that they're hiding in. And it's so simple, but so, under Fincher's eye, complicated and really thrilling and fun. And it's his last, I think, maybe we could say this, his last purely popcorn film, because almost all of his other films since then have different aspirations. Even The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo or Gone Girl, which are twisty thrillers, have a very different vibe to Panic Room. And I find it such a fun film for many reasons, but also then reading about the troubled production afterwards. It was in the New York Times profile that came out last week where Fincher does not like this movie, but his pal Steven Soderbergh loves it and loves to torment him, saying, I've just rewatched Panic Room again, and sends him screen grabs.
I love that.
The
so
idea
much.
Of bullying your friend by doing that is just hilarious to me. Do you think in future years, like, Fincher's gonna start screen capping The Laundromat and say, dude, what were you thinking with Meryl Streep and the rubber mask? Like, I really love that idea.
But it's the fact that Steven Soderbergh is coming from a position of actually loving the film. It's he says that it's the Fincher he watches so many times.
As he should. It's a good movie. I mean, I know Fincher's a perfectionist, but like, come on, dude, it's a good movie. I mean, calm down.
Do you two like this movie? What's your take on it, Adam?
I like it a lot. I rewatched it, not actually for this podcast, but just over the summer during lockdown. Watched it. Liked it a lot more than I remembered. I think it is quite a modest film in a lot of ways, but it's just really tight and really effective. It is quite a kind of old school, like, Hitchcockian thriller. I love this, like, single location and the way he uses that. I love the whole, like, architecture of the set and, you know, the way it's all mapped out. Like, it's one of those films which in lesser hands I think could be a bit of a mess. And actually could be quite tedious, but it's really to Fincher's credit that he's so in control of every... I mean, he is obviously, as we've said, a bit of a control freak and a perfectionist, but, you know, the fact that every element of it is so finely tuned and you know exactly where you are with it at all times. And actually, you're not too concerned in terms of, like, where it's going necessarily, but it's very... Yeah, it's a really fun, tight, well-executed...
And it's a perfect example of Fincher as a filmmaker with a vision elevating a script that is a David Koepp script from the spec script era where he got paid millions of dollars for this idea. And really, you could imagine this being sort of video shop fodder if it weren't for that ambition.
This came out the same year. This came out the same year as Phone right. Booth. And I think there's some parallels, and someone like Joel Schumacher, you know, I can imagine him doing a film like Panic Room. And I think I can imagine Fincher doing a film like Phone Booth even at this time. There was a bit of an appetite for these, as you say, like DVD fodder type blockbusters. And I think what Fincher brings to it is something which I think there's very few Hollywood directors that can kind of do this, that can match this. And there's a lot of imitators out there. That's the other thing. It's like easy to think of Fincher as being someone with a lot of peers, but I think actually there's a lot of people who've kind of followed in his footsteps.
And I think placing this within the arc of his career is really fascinating. Of course, now that he's 11 films in, Panic Room lands right at the middle And it's, as we said, Seven and Fight Club, Zodiac and The Social Network loom very large over the rest. I do think that this period where he was the twisty-turny, high-concept director with particularly The Game and Panic Room, they can be overlooked a little bit, probably because they don't have that prestige attached to it or the controversy attached to them, but are both worth rewatching. And also the fact that I don't think he looks back very fondly on The Game either.
Mm.
Because that's the one with Michael Douglas being pulled into The Game.
The Game is brilliant.
I love The Game. Yeah.
I think it's quite fun as well.
I only watched it for the first time this year, and at the beginning of this year, and I was blown away. I was annoyed it had taken me so long to watch it. I think it's a great film. I really do. And I hate Sean Penn. So for me to enjoy that film despite Sean Penn is quite something. But I was reading about the production history of Panic Room for this podcast, and it's one of those films where I definitely remember seeing bits of it on TV, because I remembered the bit at the end with Forest Whitaker standing in the backyard, and like that, I think that is one of the kind of, if I was doing a montage of David Fincher's career, like that scene would be like the Bonds like blowing in the wind would be one of the things I would include. I think it's a really brilliant scene which kind of sums up the film. But I was fascinated to learn that originally Nicole Kidman was going to play Jodie Foster's role. I thought that was so interesting that he basically when Kidman dropped out, he reshaped the whole thing and made Jodie Foster's character much more able to fight back, I guess. In the original, Kidman was meant to be a kind of like helpless Manhattan housewife, whereas Foster's very like, part of the joy I get out of this film is seeing like this incredibly competent woman like getting herself out of scrapes and being very level-headed in what a situation which I'm sure most of us would never be that competent. But she is like, she always has a plan. I think that's kind of one of the most rewarding things for me about the film, is like it never treats her as inferior because she's a woman or something. She's perfectly capable of like not only handling her own, but it not being an issue. You know, it's just kind of, yeah, look at this badass woman being able to go up against these three, well, two psychopaths and one mild-mannered locksmith.
It's a really good counterexample to what we talked about earlier about how he has this reputation of being a very macho masculine filmmaker. It's very rare that we have mother-daughter thrillers like this.
Yeah.
And the relationship that they have, Jodie Foster and Kay Stew, is so central to the film, and it treats it seriously and with sensitivity as well. Particularly the growth of Jodie Foster's character, where in the opening scene where she's being shown round the house, she's almost, I mean, Jodie Foster has the fact that she's very small, so she can't command a room, but then by the end she's taken charge. I must make a note that Kay Stew, who has a sort of, I think it's meant to be diabetes, but they never really state what it is that she has, at one point where she's got like high blood pressure, she's trying to level it out, she recites the Capitol back catalogue of the Beatles, so the US albums, including Yesterday and Today, etc. So as the pronounced Beatles fan in the room, that was something I I appreciated.
And a nice little connection to Benjamin Button there, of course. It's exactly, what's going on with Fincher and the Beatles? Is this like a thing I don't know about? Is he like a huge Beatles stan?
He is interesting, isn't he? He has all of these little nods and references. So the ending of the film, as you say, the Bonds blowing in the wind is a reference to the end of The Killing, the early Kubrick film. He has Hitchcock references peppered throughout. But he's not Tarantino. He's not the Magpie.
Yeah. It's not clearly always
there.
When you watch a Tarantino film, your immediate reaction is, yes, Tarantino, I enjoyed that film too. Whereas Fincher, I think it's a lot more subtle, and you can watch these films 10 times over and still get something from them. They do have like, I mean, this year, I think I've rewatched all of his films apart from Alien 3, because who's got time for that? But I rewatched Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, and I still got so much from it on a rewatch. I think he is like, he manages to do that rare thing of like always keeping me entertained, even with something I've seen like 10 times over.
So Girl with a Dragon Tattoo is the one I've not rewatched since release. I wasn't a big fan of it on first watch.
Really?
So would you recommend that as one to go back on?
I would, definitely. I think it's fascinating as well to think about Rooney Mara's career, because he obviously, Fincher cast her in that, having worked with her on Social Network for two scenes. And I remember at the time there was such a kind of to-do about them even making Girl with a Dragon Tattoo because of it being so recent after the Norwegian edition. And there's a lot of rightful controversy about American directors remaking foreign language films for a Hollywood audience. But I think this is one of the rare examples where not only is it a great remake, it's maybe better than the original, in my opinion. I think it's definitely worth a rewatch. I think it's another great example of his thriller chops, but also he can make a film about a strong female character. I really have no truck with the misogynist claims. I really think it's a great movie, and it's a shame that Rooney Mara doesn't really do kind of that sort of thing anymore. Not to give Girl with a Dragon Tattoo too much airtime, but I know that there was a lot of controversy around the making of that film, and apparently she had a really hard time making it, and he pushed her really hard. But the performance that she gives, and to be fair, the performance that Daniel Craig gives, I think are so kind of lived in, and they really both completely disappear into this twisted world that the film is set. I would highly recommend a rewatch or a watch if you haven't seen it before.
Yeah, his relationship with actors is fascinating. And, as I say, Brad Pitt is clearly a fan, returning actor. But I think even Brad Pitt refers to Fincher as using his actors almost as cattle. Jodie Foster, I think, at the time said that she'd never worked as hard as on Panic Room, where she'd be doing hundreds of takes of certain lines. Because, of course, since everything around the actors is so fixed, the actors have to nail things time and again.
Was
and
it Jake so Gyllenhaal who with... said about Zodiac as well? Yeah, about having to do 100 takes and it being exhausting.
So maybe when he works with actors from different sorts of traditions of acting, I know that I read that in Mank, Gary Oldman having to redo scenes over and over again, and he's somebody who bridges both the theatrical tradition but also a more emotional method tradition as well. He's a fascinating filmmaker, and that probably goes all the way back to Hitchcock too, using the actors like cattle. It's fascinating.
For all of that, he manages to get some pretty amazing performances out of people. I mean, talking about things like The Social Network and Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, I think they're some of those actors, respective actors, have strongest ever performances. And even with Panic Room, maybe not one of Jodie Foster's most memorable, but it's certainly building on a legacy and, again, a preconception of her as an actor. And I think going on the, strong female character theme, as you were saying, Hannah, you can't watch this and not think of Silence of the Lambs for me. It's almost the tables have been turned and that she's kind of trapped in this box type room now. But you watch that and you know that she's going to be able to get out of it because she's like Clarice Starling, right? She's going to find a way. She's going to handle it. I think same way as we're talking about Ben Affleck, he's a bit of a douchebag, but he's kind of all right, really. And I think Fincher is a very, very canny caster of actors and knows exactly the right kind of person, the right kind of persona to put in each
of
his
sometimes
films.
That results in maybe an actor giving their single great performance in a film. So Jesse Eisenberg, for example, when he's in Social Network, is this something we've never seen in him before? And he's never really found that again since.
I would say most of that cast, their one good performer. Armie Hammer, I think, Call Me By Your Name, yeah. But, he's so good as the Winklevi twins. And Andrew Garfield as well, I think. He's remarkable in that film. And we must say Justin Timberlake as well, even though, Justin Timberlake, he's still pretty good. Good value, I think.
Well, I know we've not spoken about The Social Network on here, but that's one I rewatched last week and it is even better in retrospect. You think, surely it'll seem quaint seeing where Facebook goes 10 years on from The Social Network release in 2010. But no, all of the rotten seeds are planted in there. But also, as you say, every actor from that film was then rammed down our throats in more films to come. Yeah. Andrew Garfield, even Caleb Landry Jones, who's there in just a blink and miss scene. He's in the house party that gets raided that Justin Timberlake puts on late in the show. And he's just there in the background. You're like, even you went and had a whole career after this.
And another one that features a Beatles song. I remember again, when I saw that film in the cinema, mind totally blown by that ending. I was just like, you're going to drop Baby You're a Rich Man on me now. Something we picked three quite serious films, but we talked about it a little bit ago, I think like David Fincher's sense of humor is vastly underrated. I think he's an incredibly funny filmmaker. And rewatching Gone Girl the other night, you know, there's a wonderful moment with Ben Affleck where he's doing the he's solving the riddles for his anniversary treasure hunt, and he reads it out loud. And then he thinks about it for a second and his little face lights up and he goes, I know this one. And it's such a like such a funny moment of like this kind of dumb guy, like finally like realizing something. It's just, you know, I know this comes across, I think, in his interview with David from the magazine. He has an incredible sense of humor. I think he really is like, I'd love to see him do like a kind of screwball comedy. There's elements of that in Mank for sure. But like, I'd love see him just do something that is like pure funny.
Even Benjamin Button, you've got those little vignettes with the guy who keeps getting struck by lightning and it's done in this like sepia tinted like Buster Keaton, you know, that is so funny. I mean, it kind of like, you know, puts the brakes on the film pretty hard every time that comes in, but you kind of forgive it just because it's so delightful. And after the second or third time, you know, you're kind of waiting for the fifth and sixth.
And of course,
seventh.
I think
people forget about that sense of humor and take he's such a good interview. You know, watching him, hearing him, reading him being interviewed, but some people might take the things he says a bit too seriously.
Yeah,
he's just having a laugh with us.
This is why I'm kind of skeptical about this cancel culture thing, because I think he might have said this is a joke and now it's like a very serious like thing. But well, I mean, we should mention as well the fabulous story from Fight Club, since we haven't spoken about Fight Club, about the line in the script that he was told to take out by the studio. And he replaced it with what has become like an iconic line in the annals of Fincher history, which is when Marla Singer sleeps with Brad Pitt. And afterwards she says, I haven't been fucked like that since grade school, which I'm sure will get bleaked on this podcast. But yeah, that was a pure like Fincherism that I believe annoyed the studio even more. But they couldn't take it out because it was too late by that point.
I think he had said that he agreed that was the one thing in the script he would change, as long as they agreed, whatever it was, to keep in what he changed it to, and he made it worse.
So David Fincher. So we will be talking about Mank on a future episode. You can also pick up the issue as well, which has lots of Mank-related content in there. I still can't get over that title. That's a terrible title.
It's not good.
You have to hear a lot of characters say Mank all the way through that. It just doesn't work in English. Maybe we should adopt 1940s American Hollywood accents when we say it. Adam, Hannah, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about David Fincher. It's been a while since we've spoken. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks. It's been a nice tonic for lockdown too, talking about David Fincher. I think he's a good lockdown filmmaker to get into as well, because, you know, not very many films, which is the ideal.
Not very many films. Would we recommend Mindhunter afterwards?
Yes.
Oh yeah, definitely.
I was such a skeptic with Mindhunter. I watched the first few episodes when it came out, didn't like it, and then came back to it about a year ago, and really ate my words. I think it's fantastic. He said in recent interviews for Mank that he's probably not going to make a third season, which makes me really sad, because I think it's a really, really great, not only like Fincher show, but like a great crime show. We don't get a lot of those nowadays. It's all very like hokey true crime, but Mindhunter really holds up.
Are they making more of it, or is he just not doing it?
I think he said it's unlikely to get a season three.
Because there's like a whole plot there that is just like dangling.
Yeah.
They've been teasing that
the
two seasons.
BTK killer. Yeah. We're never gonna get there.
So 11 films, the TV series Mindhunter, and the music videos too, I'd recommend. They're definitely part of the story, particularly if you go and read Sydney Urbanek's amazing article digging into the relationship between Fincher and Madonna. Which is well worth a read, because we think that he starts in the late 90s, but actually there's a whole story before that, all part of the big Fincher fable. Listeners, if you have any thoughts on David Fincher, I'm sure many of you have many thoughts, let us know at the usual channels, at LWLies on Twitter, truthandmovies at lwlies.com via email. And of course, there's also the comment section at lwlies.com/podcast. Adam, Hannah, thank you so much for talking with me today. I've been Michael Leader. Listen out for our Mank podcast soon.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands.
They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.